The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 25th, 2019. Yes, it's another emergency podcast, and I'm not even going to do very much of an introduction because you all know why we're here. The president released the transcript of his conversation with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. It contains a lot of material, and we've got an incredible group of people to go over it. We have a lot of people to go over it. And so rather than introduce everybody at the outset, I'm just going to introduce people as I bring them into the conversation and hope that will make it easier for people to follow. So Quinta Jurecic, Lawfare Managing Editor, give me to start with an overview as neutrally as you can of what is in this document.
The document is a memo putting together basically notes of a conversation between President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Functionally, for our purposes, the important material involves Trump's sort of sudden shift of the conversation away from Zelensky talking about, you know, how great the relationship between the U.S. and Ukraine is to a discussion of things Trump would like Zelensky to do for him. Specifically, multiple times he indicates that he will have both his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and the Attorney General, Bill Barr, reach out to Zelensky to help Zelensky in conducting an investigation of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden. And Zelensky kind of, at some point, seems to push Trump away. At some point, seems to yield. He does say at one point, we will conduct that investigation. There's also a discussion of the previous U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, who at that point had been pushed out. Zelensky sort of agrees with Trump that she was not a very good ambassador, and there seems to be a hint on Trump's part that something bad may be coming in the future for her, but it's not really clear what he's talking about.
And to be a little bit less neutral about this, and that was admirably neutral, the president released this as a document that supposedly shows that this was a perfect conversation, I believe is his words, a beautiful conversation, and that there's no impropriety in his conduct in it at all. Do you think this release will quell the suggestion that Trump behaved inappropriately in this July 25th call?
I will say, when I read it, I was absolutely floored. It is so much worse than I could possibly have imagined. I suppose there is not literally a sentence where Trump says, investigate the Bidens or I will withhold military aid to Ukraine. But there is a quid and there is a quo. There may not be a pro there, but it's heavily implied. And the part that really struck me was the involvement of the Justice Department. It had not been previously reported that Bill Barr had been implicated in this at any level. The Justice Department says that Barr did not reach out to the Ukrainian government and was not aware of this. But it is pretty striking that Trump is trying not only to use his personal lawyer to aid in this push, but pulling in the official power of the Department of Justice as well.
Okay, Susan. Susan Hennessy, Lawfare's executive editor. Do you agree that this is how do you, on the sort of big deal scale from what you expected to what to the reality, is this less bad, about as bad, or worse than you expected it to be?
So I agree with Quinta. It's very, very bad. I don't know that I can judge if it's worse than I expected or not. It's extremely serious. Nothing in this transcript helps the president. And the transcript alone supports very, very serious allegations of abuse and sort of proves very serious allegations of abuse.
And how would you characterize the abuse that the transcript proves or supports?
So I think that this is an area in which when you read the call transcript, the abuse is plain on its face, right? That something corrupt is happening here, that this is not what the president of the United States is supposed to be doing. But it can actually be kind of difficult to tease out specifically what is happening and why it's abusive. And so I think that there's a few different lines that we should be thinking about. So the first is, as Quinta mentioned, the question of sort of the quid pro quo, whether or not it's explicit or implicit. It would be a very, very serious aggravating factor if the president of the United States were tying this to the provision of military assistance, congressionally appropriated military assistance. And so I think that there's a lot in this document to support that inference. I don't know that there's enough to prove it outright, but I do think there is a lot to support the quid pro quo. That said, whenever we're talking about sort of the realm of impeachment, one, the precise sort of criminal definitions of quid pro quo required for things like the bribery statutes isn't really relevant, right? We're talking about the political calculations that members of Congress that are now in a formal impeachment inquiry are going to have to ask themselves. So that's sort of one line you might think about it. The second is the instigation of an investigation by a foreign power against a U.S. citizen, absent basically a predicate for that investigation. And so, whenever we're thinking about the president of the United States operating in a domestic context, right, he's not allowed to direct the FBI to investigate his political opponents just because he wants to harm them politically or for his political advantage. There's lots of laws and guidelines that help us understand when exactly the lines of abuses have been crossed, what sort of the protections are, and what the constitutional rights of the American citizen involved are. That's relatively clear. What's happening here is sort of the inverse of that, right? So the president of the United States is reaching outside the United States in an attempt to wield the law enforcement apparatus of a foreign government corruptly. And so that is an area in which we don't have these really, really elaborate guidelines and laws to govern us. But it's an area in which the abuse is effectively the same, and the rights of the U.S. citizen, which carry with that person wherever they are in the world, are the same. And so the fundamental abuse and the fundamental violation, is a similar one.
So, David, I want to get you involved on that precise point. David Criss, you ran the National Security Division at Justice and have this treatise on national security investigations and prosecutions. And so, first of all, I'm interested in whether, in your experience or knowledge, there is a precedent for the President of the United States reaching out to get a foreign law enforcement agency to kind of investigate somebody rather than, say, initiating or having the Justice Department initiate a domestic investigation and then reaching out for foreign cooperation with that. Have you ever heard of something like this happening before?
It's quite easy to think of examples in the past in which the Justice Department would urge a foreign prosecution, say, of a suspected terrorist because the foreign government has superior jurisdiction or better laws, or for various reasons, perhaps the U.S. doesn't have jurisdiction. And so at some level, urging foreign governments to engage in investigations is something that happens not all the time, but routinely. But I think this is a horse of a very different color, and I'm with Susan, but I think I would go further. What is so damning about this transcript or this memorandum of a call, which reads very much like a transcript, is that it shows the president apparently trying to enlist both domestic and foreign law enforcement against his political opponent. And I think there is a little bit of the frog in the boiling water syndrome going on here. It is absolutely outrageous for a president to enlist any kind of law enforcement, let alone both domestic and foreign, with the involvement of Bill Barr here, against a political opponent. So there are precedents in which the U.S. seeks foreign prosecution of some terrorist or spy or you know, even an ordinary criminal for various jurisdictional or substantive law reasons. This is the president of the United States trying to use Bill Barr, his attorney general, Rudy Giuliani, his personal lawyer, and the law enforcement apparatus of Ukraine against his political opponent, Joe Biden. And we just, I think, ought not to pass over that too readily, despite the numbing effect of the last 2 years. I think it is absolutely outrageous and utterly damning that the president is shown to have done that here.
Okay, so the Justice Department's reaction, it gets a criminal referral. And Bob Litt, you've been the general counsel to the DNI. In this case, the referral comes from the intelligence community, right? And the Justice Department declines to predicate an investigation here. What do we know about the Justice Department's reasoning on that? And to what extent should we say, well, that's outrageous, this is egregious presidential misconduct, it needs to be investigated? Or should we say, well, actually, it's egregious presidential misconduct, but it kind of doesn't sound in criminal law. It sounds in impeachment. And so we really should be thinking about this in congressional terms, not in criminal terms. How did you react to hearing that the Justice Department turned it down?
Well, let me say, first of all, in response to your last question, Ben, given this Justice Department, I think the answer to your question of do we need to rely on Congress rather than the Justice Department is fairly obvious. Among other things, this Justice Department under Attorney General Barr takes the firm position that a president can't be even investigated criminally while in office. The other point to mention, there was the Office of Legal Counsel today released a unclassified version of an opinion that they had earlier provided to the DNI about his obligations under this. This describes that the only criminal matter that the Department of Justice looked at was a potential campaign finance violation, which is to say that the investigation of a political opponent of the president would be a thing of value to the president, and coming from a foreign government, that would be an illegal campaign contribution. And the Department of Justice concluded, in a manner similar to that which Special Counsel Mueller investigated similar claims, that because you couldn't put a value on a foreign investigation, it didn't constitute a campaign finance violation that could be prosecuted criminally. That said, it strikes me that the campaign finance violation is really not the relevant thing to look at here, even from a criminal perspective. If you look at the transcript, and it's not a transcript, and so we don't know exactly what words are said, But the way this unfolds is that Zelensky says, thank you for everything you've done for our defense. We're ready to go ahead with more purchases, to which President Trump describes, well, there's something, there's a favor I'd like you to do for us. And boy, if this was a mafia don walked in to a store and used similar language, it would not be hard to view that as extortion or soliciting of a bribe. Now, as I said, there's no prospect that this is going to be investigated criminally. So it does strike me that particularly given since the Constitution specifically calls out bribery as a basis for impeachment, that this is something that is worthy of congressional focus.
All right. Bob Bauer, former White House counsel and conveniently campaign finance expert. How reasonable is the Justice Department's, I mean, quite apart from whether it's motivated by Barr's desire to be a team player on the Trump team, is the view that whatever this is, it ain't a campaign finance violation. Is that reasonable?
Let's set aside for the second whether, you know, somebody really wants to go the campaign finance route, whether it's advisable relative to other potential exposure like the one that Bob Litt identified, or whether we should be talking about that rather than impeachment. Let's just set that aside for a second. Just talk about it on the merits. As you know, I have been baffled. I was baffled by the Mueller analysis on this issue. What strikes me in this particular case is, and I haven't seen anything in writing from the Department of Justice, but apparently the concern of the department was that it was impossible to treat this as the solicitation or receipt of something of value from a foreign government to support a political campaign, because it was somehow not quantifiable. You couldn't know that it cost any, you know, what the value was. First of all, it isn't clear that any effort was made to quantify it. And what strikes me is that there are two parts to this. One is Donald Trump picking up the telephone and jawboning the foreign leader about opening up an investigation. But the second is the context in which this call has taken place, and that is on the basis of public reports, extensive efforts by Rudy Giuliani to advance on behalf of the president as his personal attorney, and he's never denied, he's been acting on behalf of the president, to advance the same objective. And he is traveling to Ukraine. He has people on his behalf traveling to Ukraine. He's spending money to do it. And so it's a little odd to say, well, we can't quantify it, when it's very clear that there are expenditures. And the statute is very, very clear that you may not you may not solicit anything of value from a foreign national, anything at all of value, right? So it doesn't seem like the analysis has gone very deeply. You know, what did the government spend to host Rudy Giuliani when he was in Ukraine? What actually took place here on the facts? So I'm not scrambling here to argue that this should be the central concern. I'm simply saying that there is a superficiality and lack of depth to at least what has been reported to be the Department of Justice's approach. And I'll conclude by saying this: the statute, which was enacted in the 60s in one form, it's been amended several times, most recently in 2002, is a very, very broad statute meant to be construed very broadly. It's the expenditure, the solicitation of support and the provision of support from a foreign government of any kind in connection with a federal election. So on the one hand, you could say that's a real quantification problem, but you could also say, well, actually, it's not. If there's activity, there are clearly resources to support that activity. And so it's less of a quantification problem than one might at first think. So that would be my reaction to that specific issue.
All right. So I want to ask you about another specific issue. I don't ever want to ask you about your representations of President Obama in a fashion that implicates any possible privilege or confidentiality. But I do want to ask you how many times you are aware of Obama soliciting a personal favor of any kind, not a policy favor, but something, you know, that accrues to his individual or political benefit from a foreign leader?
Well, I mean, the answer to that is pretty simple. I'm not aware that he ever did that, or that he ever thought of doing it, or that he ever raised with anybody the intention to do it. The only instance similar to this that I can think of, and it is a favor, if you will, quote unquote, although it was much more of a more than a favor, was Richard Nixon's use of channels to communicate to the South Vietnamese government in 1968 that if they obstructed the Paris peace talks and weakened that as a potential advantage, weakened the talks as a potential advantage to Hubert Humphrey in the 1968 general election, they could expect a better deal for him when he took office. And that is not the same as seeking, you know, to manufacture political dirt on an opponent, but it is definitely engaging a South Vietnamese, a foreign government, in an attempt to take a position underhandedly that was meant to influence the outcome of a presidential election. So the last time we've had anything like this that I'm aware of, the only other time in American history, in the Nixon candidacy, but had it been known when he became president, and it wasn't known for many years thereafter, it's now conclusively demonstrated that this happened, he would have been subject to impeachment.
And do you, is it fair to say, without lionizing Barack Obama, is it fair to say a conversation like this in the Obama White House is unthinkable?
Yes. I mean, and again, it's not because I'm wearing the Obama team jersey. It's that, I mean, who could imagine, I mean, let's just put Barack Obama out of it for a minute so my own personal biases are not at issue. It's unthinkable in an Eisenhower administration. I mean, it's unthinkable in any number of administrations. It's unthinkable. I won't start naming them, but in most presidencies that I can think of, if you set Richard Nixon aside.
Okay, so I want to bring Scott Anderson, our senior editor and foreign relations law guru, in on this. So you were a State Department lawyer for a number of years. You didn't work in a situation in which you would be privy to individual presidential phone calls with foreign leaders, to my knowledge. But what can you tell us about the sort of normal protocol when a leader like Zelensky kind of takes office and kind of has his first get-to-know-you conversation with the president? Presumably, normally, it doesn't start with an extortion, as Bob Litt put it, or a kind of near maybe extortion or solicitation of a bribe, or the demand for a favor. What would have been a normal, you know, when Trump says this was a perfect conversation, a beautiful conversation, what would a normal, typical, beautiful conversation with a newly democratically elected president in Ukraine have looked like?
Well, for one thing, I think it's worth thinking about the context of this call. So Zelensky was actually inaugurated in May 2019. So he'd been in office a little bit at this point. Really, the kicking off part of this call appears to have been a parliamentary victory by his party in the Ukraine. That's not necessarily something that always happens, but is not necessarily unusual to have a sort of contact. So there obviously is an agenda behind this call. There's a reason to have this conversation probably on both sides. And we actually see Zelensky get into that first. He talks about the fact that we want to buy more Javelin missiles from the United States. There's a request the Ukraine actually just put in a few weeks prior to this conversation in July, the first time Ukraine has ever tried to buy arms for the Foreign Military Sales Program. It has been receiving lethal assistance from the United States since 2017, but it's the first time they tried to, on top of that, also purchase a set of arms, a request that's in place. That sort of conversation isn't necessarily strange in and of itself, but what's strange here is what leads up to it and what comes out of it, what the kind of deliverables are. Leading up to it, you would expect a policy process, developing a set of talking points and a set of agenda that reflects a series of U.S. policy priorities and items. That is hard to see in this conversation, President Trump delivering any sort of talking points that have any correspondence to actual U.S. policy items. We've heard a lot of reports coming out more recently, including a number today and yesterday, talking about this breakdown in the NSC process leading surrounding U.S.-Ukraine policy. We saw the sudden removal in May of 2019 of the longstanding, at that point, U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, who had dated back to the end of the Obama administration, a career foreign service officer who was removed after being criticized by Giuliani for her alleged role in a variety of kind of conspiracy theory laden items, to the point that he claimed she was working for George Soros and involved with some sort of agenda. She was removed from office just a few months before her kind of tour of duty was set to end. And we've seen Ukraine policy get kind of pulled into this White House process that, according to reports, increasingly centered around Giuliani. And that's what we see the deliverables coming out here as well. I mean, President Trump is saying, I'm going to connect you with Attorney General Barr, presumably for things related to criminal prosecution. And then I'm going to connect you to Rudy Giuliani, somebody who's openly said, I am the president's lawyer. I am representing him in that capacity. When he went to Ukraine and spoke to Ukrainian officials in the past, he said expressly, I'm doing this to start investigations to help my client. This is not the step that you would take if you're advancing a U.S. foreign policy. You would be tying this into an apparatus so you can coordinate the arms of government. This is addressed towards something very different and a different set of priorities that Mr. Giuliani is in charge of, and presumably one much more related to the president's own interests.
All right. I want to talk about collusion, because when the Mueller report came out, the whole cry in response to it was he didn't prove collusion, right? And what would have been evidence of collusion? Like maybe a phone call in which the president says to Vladimir Putin, or the candidate says to Vladimir Putin, would you please release dirt, these emails on my political opponent, and, you know, here's what I'll do in response. Or maybe not even with the, would you, I'll do this in response. I'll, you know, would you please do this? I'd appreciate it. And that seems to me, David Chris, exactly what happens here, right? The president says to the president of a foreign country, would you please do this for me? I have a favor to ask you, and that favor involves some degree of electoral advantage to me. Why shouldn't I react to this, or should I, as everything that they claimed vindication for on collusion in the Mueller report is squarely contained within the five pages of this transcript?
I mean, I think it is extremely damning here. It is explicit in the sense that he's trying to get a foreign government to serve his political interests by investigating a political opponent. And so it's you know, it may not be an effort to interfere with the mechanics of our election, but it's clearly an effort to solicit something of value for political purposes through the use of law enforcement modalities. And the involvement of the Attorney General, and I know the Department of Justice, or at least I understand the Department of Justice, have said Barr was surprised to find that he had been mentioned, is sort of doubly troubling here. So I think this is really, really bad. And I agree with what Bob Litt and Bob Bauer have been saying. It feels like a kind of a shakedown. Whether or not it fits within any existing criminal law, whether it fits within the bribery statute 201, which applies to bribery of U.S. officials, whether it's an FCPA violation, which is typically only for commercial bribery of foreign officials, whether it's a campaign finance violation, quantifiable or not, it does, to me at least, seem squarely within the kind of misconduct that fits under the impeachment clause. And so I think it's appropriate that an impeachment review is underway.
Do you have any doubt that there are at least one impeachable offense contained within the five pages of this transcript, David?
Not really. I don't, because I think this is so outrageous, the attempt to enlist foreign and domestic, possibly law enforcement, against a political opponent. And again, I the point I was making earlier, forcefully, I guess, was I think we have lost sight of just how outrageous that is. I mean, you know, had Barack Obama, or really any president since Nixon, called a foreign leader and said, I want you to do an investigation of my political opponent. I mean, had Barack Obama done this for his Republican political opponents, I find it utterly unthinkable that that would have occurred, and that George W. Bush, in whose administration I worked, would have done it, I think is also unthinkable. This is way out from the mean, you know, more than two standard deviations removed, in my view.
All right. So,
David, this is Bob Litt. Let me just add to that. I don't think you need to hypothesize what would have happened, because if you look at the totally ginned up allegations relating to the Steele dossier, you see the Republicans making that exact claim that the Obama administration and the Democrats were enlisting foreign aid in as part of the election. And this is an outrageous thing.
Right. So, Bob, do you have any doubt that there is an impeachable offense contained within these pages?
I think you need to separate out what I would vote for as a member of the Senate and what I think is likely to result in the impeachment and removal of the president of the United States.
No, so I'm not asking for your predictive right. judgment, which I will get to later as to the congressional politics of this. When we bring in Margaret Taylor to talk about the congressional politics, we'll get to the predictive judgment. I mean, the platonic member of Congress who has sworn an oath to preserve and protect the Constitution, and one of whose tools to do that is the impeachment clauses, reads these five pages of transcript and has nothing else. There's no Mueller investigation. There's no, you know, emoluments clause. There's no anything else. All you have is these five pages. Should that person be at this point prepared to impeach the president?
I don't think that's a fair question.
I get to ask unfair questions.
I can't divorce my analysis of this from the events of the last 2.5 years. If we had a president who was otherwise competent, not corrupt, honest, list whatever set of adjectives you wanted, and this single thing came up, I'm not sure I would consider this worthy of impeachment standing alone. The problem is that it doesn't stand alone, and it's part of a pattern of a president who views the presidency as his toy to be used in whatever way benefits him personally, and that is impeachable.
Bob Bauer, what do you think? Is there any scenario in your mind in which these five pages, either standing alone or set against the context of the last 2.5 years?
He gets the easy question.
So you changed the question to make it the one you want to answer. I'm giving him the same option. Is there any way in your mind that this does not constitute an impeachable offense?
No. And no, and I would want to emphasize a couple of things. I actually want to emphasize one particular thing, which is, as we see when these things go on, we know part of the story. We don't know all of the story. We don't have a full readout on what the conversation was. We don't know how it related to the numerous attempts of Rudy Giuliani over time to convey the same expectation, the same, quote, expectation of a favor to the Ukrainian government. We don't know what kind of pressure was supplied. We don't know how this phone call related to channels by which the administration made it very clear that it was tied to supplying military aid. And so I just think on the face of it, absolutely, it's a more than a trail of breadcrumbs to an impeachable offense. I think we have hardly seen just, you know, how large the loaf when it's all assembled and fully baked will be. I just wanted to add one more point about the relationship to impeachment to law. Obviously, the Congress can appropriately define this and should appropriately define this as an abuse of power, and then can investigate and find out in full, for a full record, of what happened here. And as I suggested a second ago, I think there's a lot more to be found out. I also think that we talked about campaign finance, but I want to bring one other provision of federal law to your attention, which I'm not arguing at the moment. Applies to the President of the United States, but it certainly might inform people's understanding of what's at stake here. It's 18 U.S.C. Section 600. And let me just, trust me, you can look it up. And so I'm just going to cut a few additional words out of it to get to the point. Whoever directly or indirectly promises any benefit provided for or made possible in whole or in part by an act of Congress or any special consideration in obtaining such a benefit to any person as consideration, favor, or reward for any political activity for the support of or opposition to any candidate or any political party in connection with any general or special election, etc., shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 1 year or both. Now, I'm sure somebody rushed in and said, well, that's not what it was. It wasn't legislated, wasn't enacted to address this sort of issue. It's not clear that it applies to the president. I understand all of that. But that's been in the criminal code for some time. The use of appropriated funds as a reward for political activity. Not just, by the way, providing it, but promising it. And I raise that because, you know, I think it informs at least some of the discussion of what's really significant going on here, is that when he says, when the president says in the transcript, and who knows in what way it was edited, boy, we've done an awful lot for you, but I need a favor. And then he presses that point very hard in conjunction with whatever Giuliani said. Sort of difficult not to say that this is a benefit that he's holding out, provided by an act of Congress or made possible by an act of Congress as a favor or reward for political activity on behalf of or against a candidate for federal office.
All right. So we have so far three votes for the idea that this is either obviously or presumptively reflects impeachable conduct in a number of ways. Scott, do you want to speak up for the "this is not an impeachable offense" position?
I will not take that side of the coin on this one, Ben. You know, from my perspective, what you see in these five pages is a president who is speaking from the Situation Room, from the White House, to another power. The United States president never speaks without an element of coercion or inducement behind it. That's just not the way power relations work between states, particularly between a powerful state like the United States and a weak state like the Ukraine. He is making requests of another party for his personal benefit, and he is very clearly using and clothing himself with all the power and authority that U.S. law and U.S. policy gives him.
Okay, but let me stop you right there, because I want to, you know, when the U.S. interacts with a foreign entity, it is always extortion or bribery, right? We'll do this for you. You know, that's a nice country there you got there. It'd be a shame if the Russians did anything to it. Be part of our block and will protect you. I mean, what is NATO but a giant protection racket? So what makes this extortion different from all other extortion when the United States, I'm being disparaging, a bit sardonically, but there is, as you say, always an element of coercion when we engage with foreign countries. What makes this illegitimate, whereas, you know, not a routine exercise of such power?
Because here the president is using that coercion to ask for a set of deliverables that only benefit himself politically, not the interests of the United States he is supposed to be representing, but strictly himself. And if you look at what the founders meant by high crimes and misdemeanors, what the idea behind the power of impeachment was, the key idea was malfeasance in office, and the idea of a leader abusing his office for his own advantage and his own benefit. And it's hard to imagine a more clear-cut example than this.
All right. Want to bring in Margaret to talk about the congressional politics of this. We have, you know, all the members of Congress in the Jungle Studio seem to be voting for impeachment. The cascade of Democrats heading in that direction, including Speaker Pelosi, is become pretty dramatic. So where are we now?
So just today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi did say in a statement that this that the administration released confirms the need for an impeachment inquiry of a president who, and she quote, and I quote her, has tried to make lawlessness a virtue in America and now is exporting it abroad, unquote. So I think that sort of embodies where the bulk of House Democrats are. There's now 208 Democrats that have sort of come out overtly in support of the impeachment inquiry, plus one independent. As you know, 218 are needed to actually impeach. Just a note on House Republicans. Earlier today, Kevin McCarthy said that he hadn't read the transcript, but he also contended that it was the president of Ukraine who first brought up the Bidens. And as we all know, the actual text of this document shows that it was, in fact, Trump who brought up Biden first. One question, I think, going forward for House Democrats will be a question of what Bill Barr's role is in all of this. It's hard to see at this point how that's not investigated as part of the at least this broader sort of impeachment investigation. On the Senate side, it's a little difficult to know exactly where Senate Republicans will land. Senate Republicans have been, some of them have been saying one thing privately to reporters, for example, and anonymously, and another thing publicly. Privately, at least one Republican senator said that the administration's release of this document was a, quote, huge mistake, unquote. Mitt Romney said, it remains troubling in the extreme. It's deeply troubling, unquote. On the other hand, you have Lindsey Graham saying, well, there was no quid pro quo here, so there doesn't seem to be a problem. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is having a closed-door lunch today, Wednesday, and I think we'll know after that sort of where Senate Republicans are. In terms of steps forward, I think what this memo does is probably energize and maybe supercharge the efforts of House Democrats to move forward quickly on impeachment. And Nancy Pelosi did get together the leadership team to discuss concrete ways forward. She got them together today to discuss that.
And when you say, you said 208?
208.
So 200,
House Democrats.
208 is getting awfully close to a majority of the House, right? You need 217, I think, or 218 is a voting majority. So are the 208 people who support an inquiry or people who say the president should be impeached?
So my understanding is that that is people who have said publicly that they now support an impeachment inquiry. As I sit here, I don't have the bead on who actually is saying I now support a vote on articles of impeachment. So that's unknown. It hasn't really been the question the reporters have been asking.
All right. So the next thing that's going to happen in the interbranch confrontation is tomorrow's appearance by the acting DNI Joseph McGuire, right? In addition to that, the White House seems to be making noises about now releasing the underlying whistleblower complaint, or at least a redacted version of it, which if it did so, would shed light, I think, on the pattern of conduct at issue, not merely the text of the specific conversation. So, Bob, what should we expect when McGuire shows up tomorrow? On the one hand, the White House has kind of taken a little bit of pressure off of the interaction in the sense that they released, you know, it doesn't so much matter what the whistleblower says anymore because the president has just said, yep, did it. Here's the transcript. On the other hand, it also, in other ways, puts a really fine point on what's the rest of the fact pattern that we're talking about here. So what happens when McGuire shows up tomorrow?
Yeah, let me just, first of all, emphasize the point that even though we've had this National Security Council memorandum of the conversation released, press reports suggested that the whistleblower was concerned about multiple conversations, and this document that was released today does not purport to be a verbatim transcript. The whistleblower may well have heard more details, so I don't think releasing this document by any means ends the need to get the whistleblower's statement out there. I think that what happens with McGuire's testimony tomorrow is going to depend substantially on whether or not the White House, between now and that time, reaches some kind of agreement with the committees to get them access to the whistleblower's complaint, and not a redacted version of it, because nobody will trust this administration to do honest redactions. but a full version of it. If that happens, if the committee or the Gang of Eight or some group is able to review the whistleblower's complaint beforehand, then I think a lot of the steam goes out of the Maguire hearing tomorrow. Because remember that there are really two separate issues. One is, was the DNI obligated to transmit the complaint? And that's the matter on which the OLC opinion exists. And I expect that Maguire will take some incoming for having the temerity to consult with the Department of Justice on a legal issue.
And just to be clear, you think his conduct there is defensible and appropriate?
Absolutely. I don't have any problem. Had I been general counsel at the DNI at the time this particular complaint came in, I might well have recommended that we go and get a legal opinion on it. At a minimum, I would have recommended that we make sure that the White House is aware of this, and that probably would have resulted in the Department of Justice's intervention under any circumstances. But if the complaint has not been released or the whistleblower hasn't been freed to go up and talk to Congress, then I think there will be much more pressure on Maguire to push him towards either saying, well, yes, we'll find a way to provide this to you, or essentially to say, my hands are tied here. This is the White House and the Department of Justice who are preventing me from doing this.
I just want to say, I haven't said this, but I want to say it very clearly. I think if you are Adam Schiff here, it is not a good idea to treat the ODNI as effectively part of the administration for purposes of, you know, you're kind of at war with the White House. Don't extend that down into the intelligence community, because it is not like they have a lot of options here. And by the way, this is the professional intelligence apparatus that, you know, is going to outlast this administration one way or another. And, you know, I do think there's a real risk of, you know, letting the fight with the White House pollute or disrupt the relationship between the agencies and the oversight committees, which, you know, need to have an exogenous existence there. Am I being sort of overly conservative here?
No, not at all. I think that Schiff should recognize what I believe to be the case, which is that the ODNI probably wanted to transmit this to Congress and was prevented from doing so. If I could just go in a slightly different direction for a second, I think there is something very important that could come out of the hearing tomorrow, and that is to get both Maguire and the Republicans on the Intelligence Committee to commit themselves to protecting this whistleblower from any kind of retaliation. And that is not a theoretical issue here, because you've seen the president attack the whistleblower as partisan. The OLC opinion sort of gratuitously inserts language that says that the whistleblower may have had a partisan motivation. This is a real stress test for the whistleblower system, for the intelligence community. This is someone, he or she, absolutely went by the book and followed all the rules. And if this person cannot be protected from retaliation, the result is going to be that essentially people are going to conclude Edward Snowden was right. There is no point in being a whistleblower within the system. If I have a problem, I've got to go and leak it. And that would be extremely damaging to the country. And so I think that one positive thing that can come out of this hearing tomorrow is a sort of full-throated commitment from the DNI and from Congress that says, we will ensure that this whistleblower is protected.
Okay, Margaret, I want to finish up with you on this point. Bob and I have kind of laid down the sort of executive branch, the institutional executive branch, not the president's equities, but the intelligence community's equities. And so you've been a committee counsel. The congressional equities here are to get as much information as possible and to not let the White House get away with withholding it, including by, you know, directing the intelligence community to withhold stuff. So how do you protect the concerns as Adam Schiff? You're going to be Adam Schiff for purposes of this conversation. How do you protect the concerns that Bob and I have laid out while still preserving this sort of essential congressional investigative equities here? What's the formula for Adam Schiff to behave, by which for him to behave tomorrow that you know, kind of threads the needle?
So that's a difficult question. I just want to back up a tiny bit and say, make a note that the Senate yesterday unanimously agreed to a resolution calling for the whistleblower complaint to be turned over to the intelligence committees immediately. It's a resolution. It's not like a law or anything, but that shows, some force behind, including bipartisan force behind getting the actual complaint. A similar thing is being done in the House. So, in terms of protecting a whistleblower, I think that Adam Schiff will be guided by what the desires of the whistleblower, him or herself, is, for sure, although that may not be the only consideration. That may mean having the whistleblower come in a closed space where the person's identity is not revealed. If the whistleblower wants to come forward and testify in an open hearing, that's a different thing. I do think Congress can and should take whatever steps it can to try to protect the person. But it's not clear to me that the enactment of a new law or something is going to prevent the president and the president's allies from kind of going after the person or from firing the person. So I think it's difficult to know. I do think Schiff will be guided by what the preferences of the whistleblower are.
All right. So you mentioned kind of in passing before that we are now in a kind of full-blown impeachment inquiry. One thing that has not involved is what I had always thought was the kind of hallmark of the inauguration of an impeachment inquiry, which is a congressional resolution passed authorizing the Judiciary Committee to engage in an impeachment inquiry. And so this is this long conversation that we've been going back and forth about for months now of, is something an impeachment investigation when you call it an investigation and an inquiry or is there actually some formal difference? And so I guess I want to close with the question. Everybody on this podcast seems to be insistent that this is an issue Congress has to think about in the language of impeachment. Do we now have the infrastructure in Congress to consider an impeachment question seriously, or is there still a missing step?
My view is that the infrastructure is already there. It has been there for a while. My colleague Molly Reynolds and I have written several pieces on this without going into too much detail because we've already done it on this podcast before. The original sort of reasons for doing a full House resolution authorizing an impeachment inquiry in the past, it's a little different right now these days because so many of the types of powers and authorities that a committee needs to conduct this type of inquiry have already been given to the Judiciary Committee. And the Judiciary Committee has taken certain steps, including voting on a resolution authorizing itself to do certain procedures that are already been delegated to it by the full House. So I think the infrastructure is already in place. I don't think there needs sort of legally or technically to be a full House vote authorizing this. But I do think that House Republicans, and they are already making this argument, they are basically saying this isn't a legitimate impeachment inquiry because there hasn't been a full vote by the House. So I think that's a political point that House Republicans have made and will continue to make. Whether it's sort of significant in any meaningful way, I don't really think so. Once articles of impeachment are voted on, this question is for sure going to go away. But I think it will be kind of a political point between now and then.
We're going to leave it there. This has been a special edition, an emergency edition of the Lawfare podcast. Thanks so much to, on incredibly short notice, to Susan Hennessy, Quinta Jurassic, Scott Anderson, David Chris, Bob Bauer, Bob Litt, and Margaret Taylor for joining us in a kind of tag team Lawfare podcast. Our audio engineers today were Michaela Fogel and Jacob Schultz, who were also kind of tag teaming in and out of the control chair. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music, when we have music, which we don't on Emergency Podcast, is performed by Sophia Yan. And our promotional vehicle to share the Lawfare podcast is you, the listener. So I want you right now, because you're listening to an Emergency podcast, to, in an emergency fashion, tweet about it, share it on Facebook, and for God's sake, or we will impeach you if you don't. Rate and review us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on whatever podcast distribution you use. And by the way, buy some Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.